Montreal, good Sunday afternoon. Sparrow Wiseman here with Rick McConomy. And we're going to rattle your chains a bit, and we're going to want to hear from you because you're going to get real angry about what I've got to say in the next few minutes. You know, if you paid attention to the news this past week, you could have been struck by the disconnect between the attention given to the salacious rather than the serious. Judging by inches of ink, one would think that all the important issues that Canada's got has been solved. We've been flooded with comment on Gretzky's alleged gambling, or at least his wife's. Of course, it's okay for our government to instigate gambling in the poorest areas of our cities. We got inundated with McGill's naked co-eds, the raising of the age of sexual consent, Montreal hiring more cops to stop the terrible threat of jaywalking, and consideration was even being given to confiscating cars of anyone committing the horrible deed of picking up a hooker on the street. And of course, not to mention the fact that Canada lost to Switzerland yesterday. Well, except for Canada losing to Switzerland, guess what? None of the above should be the business of the state. While all this toil and tumult was going on, not much public notice was taken of a critical report from the Vanier Institute of the Family that demonstrated that the annual household income of Canadian families increased by just $500 over the past 15 years. While the same period saw the greatest concentration of wealth and widening of economic disparity in our history. No cries of objection from compassionate state authorities were heard when yet another harassing police raid that turned up nothing was carried out against a group of restaurant owners, ostensibly to enforce yet another set of suffocating government regulations, and little criticism was expressed over the Quebec government's laughable attempt to fix the wait time crisis in health care by throwing 0.1% of the health care budget at the problem while maintaining the baseline of the currently objectionable 6-month waiting periods they were all trying to get rid of. Little attention was paid to the submission and self-censorship of Canadians as they continued to compromise their freedom of expression in order to placate radical Muslims. It reached the point of such madness that our defense minister actually suggested that our troops in Afghanistan would be in greater danger if the cartoons of Muhammad continued to be printed. Well, what are our troops fighting for if not to protect our most cherished freedoms? Then all are there for target practice, for God's sakes. And you know what? All the above is the state's business. And the state is failing. How much is enough? We want to hear from you. So this week, we're going to examine why Canadians have become so trivial and naive. Are we so lethargic that we can only concern ourselves with diversion and never with dissent? Have we traded in any semblance of courage for complacency? And we'll examine if our very apathy is being used to lead us straight down the road into another period of straitjacket blue laws. So today, we're going to look at bets, butts, booze, and blasphemies. Why are we such a silly people? Rick, am I cranky enough today?
You got it, but this is insane. I mean, we're going in all the wrong directions, and we seem to be complicating it by insisting on repeatedly doing the same things.
Are people really that... You know, I was talking to Keith Randall early this morning, and Keith said, well, maybe the reason people are only concerned about the small stuff is they feel that's the only thing they have control of. And I said, well, you know, they can pick up a phone call an elected official. Of course, they're going to be called a lobbyist or some other prince of darkness. But have people really given up?
I can't believe, you know, that when they run out of sports to put on the front page of a newspaper, they put a frat party from McGill on the front page of the Journal de Montréal, worried about the fact that somebody may be taking off their top. Well, Journal de Montréal? No.
Well, Montreal, we're going to get back to this. We want to hear from you. Are we a silly people? Is it just about bets, butts, booze, and blasphemies? Right after this. Montreal, we're talking today about bets, butts, booze, and blasphemies. How much of our lives are you willing to let the state control in return for the state not doing anything on the really important issues? And why are we letting them control these matters that should be completely private? Do you get angry about any of this? Are you fed up with the laws and the regulations and the forms and everything else we have to do? We want to hear from you. 790-0006. We're joined now by Martin Patrickin. Martin, how are you? Thanks for taking time out on your Sunday.
How you doing?
How's the skiing at Le Massif?
It's lovely and cold.
I'm going to take 20 seconds, Montreal, to read you just two excerpts from a wonderful piece Martin wrote recently about Quebec embracing the nanny state. There was a time when drinking, smoking, and jaywalking were the cheapest thrills in a Montrealer's life. Buying a bottle of Planque de Depeneur, lighting up after steak frites, and bolting across St. Catherine Street like your pants were on fire used to be as Montreal's bagels, locks, and swingers clubs. They were the most obvious examples of Quebec's fabled permissiveness. The specter of safer streets and cleaner air is enough to drive a man to drink if it weren't so expensive. With these new laws, a city that was once the country's guilty pleasure will become a little more like, well, the rest of the country. What's worse, we only have ourselves to blame. Damn those rules and these prices. No one should suffer such indignity. Vive le Montréal libre. Martin, what's happened here? What do you think has happened here?
I don't know. I think it started with the health minister, who is a former doctor. I don't think that helped. I'm not sure. It's a really tough question.
Is it that recent, you think?
The jaywalking thing's been ongoing. If people don't know, that Montreal just is going to be hiring another 133 traffic cops just to police jaywalking and traffic offenses. And that started 2 or 3 years ago with a councilman named Jeremy Searle, who took on this initiative. And I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I just think it's kind of useless as far as Montreal is concerned.
Didn't it start a while ago when we started depending on the state for everything? I mean, take the daycare issue for an example. 8 years ago, Jacques Parizeau gives a speech, or 9 years ago, in which he basically says, look, we want to increase our population, we want mothers back at work faster, so we'll give you $5 a day daycare, and all of a sudden it's a droit acquis, it's an acquired right. And we have all these acquired rights we want from the state, and for that we're willing to just give away any authority over our own lives.
To a certain extent I agree with you. The thing with the daycare is that, like you say, it's become a right, and it's become a very expensive right. And whether or not you agree with the actual system, the fact is it's not necessarily tenable, I don't think, as far as prices and taxes are concerned. That's one thing that kind of bothers me about it.
Martin, Rick McConomy here. Basically, have you been following this McGill thing with the lewd pictures on the front page of the Journal de Montréal?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's unbelievable. I think that's an invasion of privacy. I mean, we have children of that age. Our youth we're supposed to protect. They splash this thing all over the front page of the newspaper. Inside the newspaper, they're running columns and columns of massage parlor ads, of ads for escort services, and God knows whatever else. I think that's the worst hypocrisy in this city.
The McGill thing. To be honest, that's you have to expect that. It's a tabloid newspaper. That's classic tabloid journalism, though. That's gonna happen regardless, right?
The incredible thing is that we're so exorcised about it. Martin, stay with us. Jamie's on the line, and he says Quebec is practically a communist state. Jamie, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Wiseman. Quebec is Quebec to me. It's like major state of hypocrisy. People want to be able to do what they want here, but they want the state to raise their kids. They want free this, we want a drug prescription plan, but basically the province is bankrupt because of a lot of, you know, buying votes for the last 30 years.
And not only on things like PharmaCare or Medicare, but that whole body of programs that have nothing to do with basic needs, just any loud group every election that wants a check gets a check for its votes, and they'll figure out later how to pay for it.
Well, you know, in this country, you know, it started with Mr. Trudeau and his deficit spending, and then Mulroney and Wilson kind of took it to a new level with record deficits, and we're left paying the bag. But Quebec has to wake up. I mean, Quebec is the only, I would say, jurisdiction in North America that's living the way it is, which is called not just way beyond our means. It's like we're living on MasterCard right now. And nobody here seems to want to pay the price to reduce our debt or deficit. At the same time, we want to be able to blow through red lights and kill people. We want to be able to do all of this, but we want the government.
But we don't want to kill people.
Well, Jamie, isn't it that we want everything for free? I mean, we want it all given to us on a silver platter. There's no more an idea working for what it is you're going to get. The government will give it to you by some program or other.
That's right, but you know what? In Quebec is basically the lone wolf crying in the wilderness. It's not like this. I mean, I travel. I've been all over Canada, United States. I've got friends. So many people, professionals who have left this province, are just disgusted. My wife and I are leaving within 2 years because we can't take the taxes anymore. And it's like everyone here always has their hand out. And the unions are working with the government, and the government's working with the unions.
But is it? You think it's just a matter that people are getting a check from the government, or they're part of a government program, or is it what? You know, the Washington Post ran a piece recently by Khrushchev's great-granddaughter, the former prime minister of Russia, the premier of the Soviet Union, who said that the reason why Stalin's popularity is rising in the Soviet Union is that under Stalin it was simply a fear for one's life, but however terrifying it was. But that fear isn't as threatening as the freedom of individual choice. Are we afraid of making individual choices for our own lives, and we're willing just to give away all that to the state? Come on. Jamie?
People want to smoke like chimneys, and people want to, you know, neglect their health, but they want the government to pay for it. So Quebec, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, if you look at Alberta and Ontario, where the economy is pretty good, and here where Montreal is basically, I call it the armpit of Canada now, I mean, we've lost so much.
Jamie, stay with us. We'll be right back after this. Jamie and Martin. Montreal, Beryl Wisen here again with Rick McConomy, and we're talking about bets, butts, boos, and blasphemies. Why are we giving up so many of our rights to the state to control? We're on the phone is journalist Martin Petriquin, who just wrote an excellent piece on Quebec as a nanny state. And Jamie, you said you and your wife are getting ready to leave Montreal in a couple of years. Why?
Well, we own a small business and we're tired, with the most recent, folly of the government, you know, having to fork out more money for parental leave. My beef with this province is that, you know, they've tried everything to increase the population. How about reducing the debt, putting money in people's pockets so they can afford to have children instead of taxing people up to you know where?
Were you with the Bouchard government when they attempted that a number of years ago and with, Martin, when he pulled back on the funding for the health services? That something you were following at that point, too, Jimmy?
I just want them to reduce the size of government federally and provincially.
Okay, well, we're on 100% on with you there.
Jamie, thanks very much and good luck.
You're welcome.
On with Andy now. Andy, how are you?
Can I say something here?
Good morning. Or good afternoon, actually.
Is that Martin? Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't know. The last caller referred to Montreal as the armpit of Canada, and I think, I trash Montreal a fair bit, but it certainly isn't the armpit of Canada. Maybe he's moving to just the real armpit of Canada.
He's moving to Saskatchewan, I guess.
I think he was talking about taxes more than anything else.
Well, I've been here a long time, but I find there's only one problem with Quebec. It's not the IDs that are being, even the daycare, whatever, but the way it is done. When they start something, it's just like the metro line that's going to Laval. Suppose it was going to be 200 million. Now it's at 800 million. No accountability. The idea, money means nothing to the people who are governing the province. And at the same time, naturally, unions say, well, if you're wasting it, we want more.
Well, do you think it's because the people who are governing the province think they can get away with bamboozling the public because nobody ever picks up a phone and calls an elected official and says, hey, you can't give me this and take away my rights there?
Yeah, the thing is this, the thing has to start from the top. I don't remember Marois, who was a minister of something?
Yes.
And she gave out a contract, or the contract was given to her husband, and at the end of the contract, he got a settlement for $80,000.
Oh, yeah, but you can tell those stories until the cows come home. The reality of it is there a commitment to reducing the debt, a commitment to bringing some kind of tax relief
to the people here?
Well, look what happens. Look what happens to Charest when he tries doing that. Automatically, he's not a Quebecer because he tried doing it, right?
But he's doing it the wrong way.
How do you mean?
Well, it's very simple. He made a comment when he was elected, and his chief of staff was transferred from the liquor board to him. And they asked him, Mr. Charest, how do you feel that your chief of staff is making almost double what you're making? Well, you see, he was making that money. He deserved this. But the people who think they deserve the money, they don't really deserve it. Any idiot can run the liquor commission.
Andy, we're talking about entitlements, right? That's something we've been through in this whole mess that we've been through federally. But provincially, remember, Bouchard did this. He tried it. He went after it, and it ran out of gas at one point in time.
They run out of gas because there's no decency among the people who get elected. Look, you had the Ville-Marie Bourreau putting somebody in position at $90,000 for some kind of a manager.
Oh, yeah. But Andy,
it's not just about money. What we're talking about this morning, what Martin Petriquin wrote about, was the fact that we're getting those very problems that you underlined that are so critical are being masked by these silly nanny state laws, almost as if to deflect the attention of the public. For example, have you ever picked up the phone and called an elected official and yelled bloody murder at him?
Oh, they don't even take my call. I'm
sure they'll take your call.
What's that?
There's one other thing.
But that's the problem. Why do you think they won't take your call? You know, every politician, when they get a written letter, thinks 100 people are behind that one written letter. That's politics 101.
The thing is this, David, as you know that before they get elected, there's a certain politician who got elected, Mr. Terp, Professor Terp.
Yes.
Before the election, he was talking to me all the time. After the election, he hasn't returned any of a call of mine. But the main thing is
Have you got his Ottawa number instead of his Quebec
number? No, it's
your
Quebec.
He's Terp, Daniel Terp.
Daniel Terp.
He's
now,
in Ottawa these days.
I'm going to mention another
thing. Is he in Ottawa?
He's in Quebec.
He's in Quebec.
He moves around.
Andy
yeah.
Martin Rick will be right back after this. We're back, Montreal, and today we're talking about bets, butts, booze, and blasphemies, and why are we giving so much of our personal conduct and control over that conduct over to the state? I'm here in studio with Rick McConomy and Martin Patriquin, well-known journalist who's written about Quebec embracing the nanny state, is on the line. Martin, our producer, Val Prudnikov, just told me I sound cranky today. Well, damn right I'm cranky. As you've heard from our callers...
No, you're not. Come on.
you've heard from our callers. They just don't get it. They don't... Nobody's remembering, you know, about the laws governing how much we can talk to our elected officials. The fact that the city of Montreal wanted to put street-level cameras on Rue Saint-Denis, ostensibly to look after drug transactions or to monitor drug transactions. All the statocratic controls on us, all they're talking about is taxes and money. Is there any way to make people get it, Martin?
That's a tough one. I just listen to you. It's a little discouraging to hear callers talk about what they were talking about. But I mean, as far as state control and stuff like that, I think Montreal has done a great job of managing to avoid it up until this point. But I think there's a certain tipping point where it's just going to happen. It's going to happen like it's happened everywhere else.
Well, the smoking trade-offs and then the idea that it's more dangerous to jaywalk because of the fact that there's so damn many potholes out there that you fall into.
You back your car into them.
Right. I mean, it's amazing. You know, the sense of priorities is something that seems to be just flipped around on the back.
But you mentioned the smoking stuff. You know, it's one thing for a government to say, okay, we realize smoking is invasive. It's not like drinking. So fine, you can't smoke in a restaurant. But I mean, the smoking law Quebec is going to put in makes it illegal for anybody to congregate to smoke inside a building, and you got to smoke 30 meters from the door of a building, and you don't even have the right to open a restaurant for smokers. I mean, how much are people going to put up with in terms of state control?
That's the part I have a real problem with. It's the overuse of the law. Like if you ban it in restaurants, it's fine. But I mean, the point of like not allowing, you know, remember that Tim Hortons had those hermetically sealed.
Yeah.
Places in they're not even allowed those anymore. Like if people are going to want to get into those coffins, go ahead, fine, do it.
There used to be one of those in the courthouse. They had to abandon it.
Basically, but that part I find idiotic.
I know what an Italian tourist was here in town a couple of years ago or last year, and he said to me, he said, I admire your indulgence towards your prostitutes. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, it's winter time. It's winter time, and there they are, standing in front of the buildings, even the office buildings, with their overcoats on, smoking, waiting for their customers to come. Right? I mean, it's amazing. You look around the city, there's all these poor people, men and women, standing out there, like, guiltily smoking out on the street because they're outside of the building.
So, I mean, so we know that there are a lot of people who remember Montreal's joie de vivre, who understand what Montreal's about, and all we're hearing is people calling about their taxes? Is that what it's come down to? An extra $34 in their checks at the end of the month, and they'll give up any discretion over their lives?
Yeah, and I know. Or that they're leaving Montreal because of the taxes. Come on.
Have we become Ontarian, God forbid?
Don't call into the radio station if you're leaving. Just go.
Just go. Stay off the armpit stuff. That's really not
Take
good.
Off.
Montreal, we want to hear from you. Are you ready to sell your souls for a few dozen extra bucks in your checks at the end of the month? Call us. Let us know, because if it's true, we're all packing. 790-0006. Martin Patriquin, thanks very much for taking time out from your skiing weekend, and good luck to you.
Thanks very much.
Take care. We'll be right back after this with George Jonas.
Bye, Martin.
Montreal, we're back, and we're talking today about how much of our personal behavior we're willing to cede to the state, and if I sound cranky, it's because I am. Most of you have called in, put everything in terms of money and dollars and cents. And Montreal, let's hear from you. There must be some of you out there who get it, that you're tired of having the state tell you where to smoke, how much to drink, where to gamble, whether or not you can pick up a hooker with your car without it being seized, and whether or not you can jaywalk. Our next guest wrote the following, and thank God for this oasis of reason, so it'll make me a little less cranky. Before I introduce him, I want to read this. Disrespect for authority is a national virtue, not a national vice. We're no longer awed by royalty, but we're still in awe of the state. We may laugh at figures in ermine, but we bow to figures in polyester. We reject the divine right of kings, but acquiesce to the divine right of bureaucrats. Flaws in national character and disposition act as safety valves for a society ruled by the command economy of the interventionist state. Corruption, disorganization, and even incompetence actually may act to mitigate statism. I want to welcome to the program George Jonas, Toronto. Mr. Jonas needs very little introduction, but I want to say that besides my open admiration for his writings, he's the finest in Canada and one of the few left of what we'd call society's critics. We've got a lot of political pundits, but critics of society and who we are really focus a spotlight on how to make ourselves better, and there aren't many doing it as well. George Jonas from Toronto, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for asking me, even though it's cold and windy.
It is cold and windy indeed. George, we've had just call after call, and the only thing people call about when we're discussing this issue is their money. Taxes are too high. We want a little bit more money. People don't get it anymore, and you know, you and I both share an Eastern European background, and I just want to read to you something that I read before. The Washington Post printed an op-ed from the great-granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, who said that the reason why Stalin's popularity is rising in the East is that under Stalin, one simply had a fear for one's life, however terrifying that was, but it wasn't as existentially threatening as the fear of freedom and individual choice. Is that what's wrong with Canadians?
I honestly don't know. All I know is that when I came to Canada close to 50 years ago, there were two sayings that were quite commonly used when people didn't really agree with you. They would either say, well, there ought to be a law.
There ought to be a law, yeah.
Or they would say, well, it's a free country. Now, you don't that often hear these sayings anymore, especially the second one. First of all, when they said there ought to be a law, there is one. In the 50 years that passed, the number of laws promulgated increased exponentially, and there is virtually no area in which there ought to be a law where there isn't one, whether there ought to be or not. And as to, well, it's a free country, it's not that free anymore.
George, you're talking 50 years ago. You're talking issues at the time that were like the Hungarian Revolution. And the 56ers that came to this country because it was a free place, because it was a place where you could speak out, because it was a place where you could live in freedom.
That was the fundamental reason why people came here.
Have we failed you?
I'm sometimes feeling a bit guilty as if by coming from an unfree part of the world, we somehow inadvertently in the luggage brought along the instinct for statism.
The expectancy that the state would be taking care at one point. It's an interesting impact. Like every wave that comes into the country has a way of turning the spin. And basically the 56ers came here and they were strongly, strongly insistent on freedom of speech and freedom to speak out. I know there's a group of them that every Saturday morning in Montreal, they meet around a coffee shop. They spend 3 hours, they tell me, every week they manage to solve all of the world's problems.
I don't know how, you know, of all the people who said there ought to be a law, I don't think anybody expected the degree of political correctness that we've reached today, which has gone to political insanity, not correctness. And George, you yourself have been a victim of it lately. For our listeners, George Jonas is the author of Vengeance, which was a book about the retaliation for the killings of the Israeli athletes at Munich. And George wrote a cover story in McLean's about how Steven Spielberg took that book and just reworked it to show a very politically correct view of assassins, which really wasn't necessary, nor was there. How did you feel when that happened, George?
Well, once your book is picked up for the movies, it's out of your hand. I simply wanted to note that the film was not saying what my book was saying. Films are not loyalty tests, so I did not as much object to it as was irked by the fact that people who only see the film attribute views to my book, which I never expressed, and I just wanted to set the record straight.
The sad thing about that was, though, you know, you could excuse many people who are working their way up the ladder or stuck in, you know, big corporations and for saying things that they think are politically correct. But when you hear a guy like Spielberg, who should have all the independence in the world to say what he wants to say and not have to act in a, quote, politically correct, unquote, fashion, you get a bit despondent. And I'd like to pick that up with you right after this. We'll be right back with George Jonas and Rick McConomy. Montreal, we're back with you, and today we're discussing political correctness and how much of our souls are ready to sell to state control. On the line with us is author and renowned columnist George Jonas from Toronto. With me in studio is Rick McConomy. George, is there any pulling back from where we are, or are we just so far gone?
Well, we seem to be going in a direction far from pulling back. Recently, in one municipality close to Toronto, apparently a decision was taken to ban toy guns in the hands of children. Ban toy guns. There's a fine levied in the municipality of, I don't know, $150 or some such thing, apparently, if your child owns a plastic water-squirting toy gun.
It's unbelievable.
And municipalities have the authority to pass such bylaws, and some incipient commissar managed to get it passed.
Let's be a bit optimistic. I mean, we've all seen enough history. The pendulum does swing back. What kind of events would it take to have the pendulum swing back?
Well, I guess that's one of the problems, that for this pendulum to swing back, the events that was precipitated are too horrendous to contemplate. Really feel either an outside calamity of some kind, or possibly a degree of state repression that finally will trigger a reaction.
But let me give you a parallel that's perhaps not as extreme. The 1950s in North America, the Eisenhower years, the Saint Laurent in America, the Saint Laurent years in Canada, were times of great conservatism, moral rectitude, in quotation marks. And then, of course, because of the demonstrations against the Vietnam War, the 60s, The pendulum swung back to where a lot of things in the 60s and 70s up to the early 80s were becoming accepted and the norms were changing. So it wasn't that cataclysmic an event. Yes, the Vietnam War was horrible, but that was the catalyst for this kind of event. Do we see anything on the horizon that could just make people explode and say, okay, enough, keep your $50 a month, just give me my freedom back?
I wish I could say yes. I don't see any signs of the zeitgeist changing. Whenever there is an electoral change, such as the recent election in Canada of a conservative government, and you try to interpret it as possibly a signal, what in fact you are seeing very quickly is a change in the rhetoric and action of the governing party.
And the underlying reality is not there. We went through it in Quebec with the Quiet Revolution, which lasted 5 years, and then the Union Nationale, the survivors of the Duplessis era, came right back into power.
It, It is very difficult, I think, that if the grip of the spirit of the times, the zeitgeist, goes in one direction, turning it around is like turning a ship at sea. It's changing directions. You can put the...
It's a very long and slow process.
It's a very long process.
Very long process.
What do we have more to fear from, the moral legislators of the right or the statocratic engineers of the left? Or they both meet at the same point at some...
The similarity between them is awesome in the sense that they are both coercive. They may want to coerce in different ways for different reasons, but the fact of coercion, which is the basic problem in any statist approach to governance, is the same for both.
The tools don't change, it's just the underlying script.
That's right.
Is there any role for indignation? I mean, something like we're trying to do with this radio show, you know, get some kind of a sense of momentum that people are just tired and sick of having it happen over and over.
Well, I suppose there is always a point. It's somewhat like looking at people trying to rub two pieces of wood together in the hope that eventually sparks will fly, and I suppose if you do it long enough, sparks will fly.
George Jonas, thank you very much for joining us from Toronto, and we're going to make some sparks fly, and there's enough of us still left. So keep the faith. Thanks very much.
Thank you,
George. Montreal will be back with you after the news at 1. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConaughey is with me in studio, and we're talking today about political correctness. Bets, butts, boos, and blasphemies, all those wonderful things we love to do that the government wants to control all the time. How much of your free will are you willing to give up? With us from Toronto, thankfully, is a breath of fresh air on this subject. General Lewis McKenzie, thanks for sharing part of your Sunday with us.
Sure, bro. How are you?
Oh, General... General Lou, here's a man.
You had to ask.
Here's a man, and I'm paraphrasing you now, who calls a spade rather than a pitchfork, and a terrorist a scumbag rather than a disenfranchised youth on a rough childhood. General Lou, what is going on with our country? We've just been discussing all this social stuff, but this past week, our defense minister said that he was afraid our troops in Afghanistan were going to be shot at if a magazine ran the Muhammad cartoons. I mean, what are they there for if not to take the fight over there to protect our freedoms over here? What the hell is going on?
I got a funny feeling, having been in that position or similar to it, that that people are maybe playing to the folks back home rather than maybe minority governments do that rather than the troops abroad. I've been called by the media umpteen times on that particular subject, and I must say that I chuckle when they say, "Do you think our troops are in more danger now as a result of cartoons?" To which my response is, "Those guys are trying to kill us." I mean,
they haven't noticed that.
The remnants of the Taliban and Al Qaeda, that's their job. It's to kill our people. And our job, as General Patton said very appropriately, our job is to have them die for their country, not have us die for ours.
And let's give the Patton quote directly, to kill more of those poor sons of bitches than they kill of ours.
Absolutely. So the media interest is somewhat appreciated because it wasn't there when we were losing even more soldiers in the Balkans per year, tragically, and more people injured, too. There was no interest whatsoever. But for some reason, maybe it's the association with the Americans, and even that's being misrepresented because the media is portraying as if we're taking over from the Americans. I think the Americans are going from 20,000 to 16,000, for heaven's sakes. They're thinning out a tiny bit, and we're responsible for an important brigade, but it's one of four in the southern part of Afghanistan. It's not a Canadian operation now. We have an area that we're responsible for, and it's one of the more dangerous areas, which means that our guys will have an opportunity to kill more of them.
It's unbelievable. And, you know, the quote I loved was the one about, you know, what you got to think about is self-censorship. You know, you've got to stop exercising that freedom because it's important out here that we're not in danger because of it.
Yeah, and I, you know, I disagree with the people that, to make a point, you know, put the cartoons on a T-shirt and wear it around. That's just inflammatory. But certainly, by way of a freedom of speech, I'm not sure why we have to keep apologizing. Certainly, there's a reasonable element within the Muslim community that that doesn't see this as an affront, and they see it as an orchestrated event that happened three months after the cartoons came out. Yeah, I mean that just shows you that it's orchestrated, and it's being orchestrated very well, and it's very successful. Lou, but that doesn't mean we run around apologizing.
Lou, exactly. We'll be right back with you. We're just going to pay some bills. Montreal, we're back talking about political correctness and how much of your control over your life you're willing to give up to the state. In studio with me is Rick McConomy. On the line from Toronto is General Lewis McKenzie, the keeper of most of the reason and sanity in this country at any given time. And Lou, there's a gentleman on the line who very much wants to get in on this conversation, Dan Romano, president of CAGE, Citizens Against Government Encroachment. Dan, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Good.
So, Beryl, man, this is driving me crazy.
How much are you as depressed as we are?
Angry. It's just nonstop. And I'm thinking, you know, it's not so much the government. I think it's really us. It's our next door neighbors, to the left, to the right. Everybody wants to be so politically correct. Everybody's so afraid of insulting somebody or frustrating somebody or stepping on toes. I mean, you can't move anymore.
So why do you think that is? I mean, you heard the previous callers. It's almost as if they're only driven by a financial consideration, that if they say something that's out of line, some bureaucrat's going to whack them and not give them the extra $30 for something, or not give them that extra grant for their favorite little charity or little league team or something.
Well, you know, it's a huge question. I'm no social anthropologist, but I suspect it's fear, it's comfort. It's, you know, Canadians are coddled. We're so lucky here. We've got a great country, a reasonably good government. We've got great laws, and people aren't used to fighting for themselves. They're not used to doing what needs to be done. They're not used to reaching out and grabbing. And if you're going to grab something, somebody else is not going to get that. You know, they're not used to doing.
But their own dignity, Lou McKenzie. Are we a coddled people?
Yeah, I guess where I notice it most, and it's turned on the lecture circuit where I spend my time. It's a real shame because you used to be able to tell jokes. Now you got to look around the audience and
oh my God,
career at risk because you might offend somebody in the audience. Now, though, because I'm no longer in the government, because let's face it, as a military person, I was sort of a civil servant. Then all hell would come bursting through. But as a freelancer, I can do that. But it's really a shame to hear people sanitize what they're saying on the radio, on TV, during speeches, presentations, or whatever these days, for the fear of offending somebody.
Is it that we should be offending each other and living with it?
Yeah. We need thicker skin, and we need to understand that people have to live with that. And, you know, offense is painful. Nobody likes to be insulted or ridiculed. But the fear of moving, of touching, of speaking is even worse.
Yeah, I think probably interpersonal relationships, it can perhaps be tolerated. Where it gets a little bit dangerous is when it starts affecting government policy at all level too, where politically correct decisions are made by those people in positions of leadership. And we all know that within Ottawa, you know, the lobbyists can be looked upon as a group that exploit political correctness. And that's where it's unfortunate, because then we start getting legislation that's based on political correctness rather than common sense.
And it blunts the reality. I know that in many of the things that I've worked on in family law over the years, I mean, the idea that you had to suddenly sanitize all of the language so that it wasn't, you know, dad usually doesn't pay the support because dad usually has to pay the support. You're into the spouse of this and the spouse of that, and you're bouncing this stuff back and forth. You lose your focus. You lose the real focus on what you're trying to do.
You know, I want to ask all of you this question. I'll throw it out to all of you. I got a number of emails when we were planning this show, and we had one lovely one from a fellow named Lucien, and we have a lot to be angry about, and we have to channel our anger, and we can't pay so much respect to those we so foolishly call or honorable this or honorable that. Another one from Normand saying, listening today makes me think that millions of us should get angry over all this nonsense being shoved in our faces. What worries me a lot is that there may not be enough angry people left, but as long as we keep hammering at it, the more of us will stand up to the will stand up at the plate and get angry. But I got another email that really bothered me, and it was from a lawyer who said, "Yeah, but we voted for this." And I said to him, "Nobody voted for this. Nobody voted for the political correctness, the cameras on the streets, the making everything illegal, because nobody told us they were going to do that. So where did that come from?"
I think it's a you often talk about the politician wants to run out, find out where the mob is going so he can jump in front and lead them.
The famous French revolutionary.
Yeah, that's what's happening. And, you know, Canadians are politically correct. That's the way I'm going to run. And I think that if enough people start writing letters consistently to the papers, speaking on shows like this, supporting journals that are a bit more independent, like the Western Standard, then people will catch on. Some politicians will catch on that there's a strong, solid, consistent, rational mob going the other direction. And maybe somebody will start leading that other direction.
And Lou McKenzie, Canadians seem to confuse political correctness with tolerance, but it's not, because it goes full circle to complete intolerance.
Yeah, and I think maybe there's a I don't want to get sued by CNN, but there's a CNN impact here, too, because we're impacted very much by the news coming out of the United States. And we all know that the CNN was a pretty darn good news organization following Gulf War I, where they got their kickstart. And then Fox started to beat them up in the polls, and they both now become entertainment. I mean, it's no longer news as much as it is entertainment.
It's sanitized.
Yeah, and there's, you know, you got to find, I wish they still had McNeil Lehr. At least they have Lehr still around on PBS. But nevertheless, you're watching entertainment masquerading as news, and political correctness has snuck in there.
We'll be right back, and we're going to tell everybody what Dan Romano, who's calling in, did the other week for entertainment. We'll be right back after this. Our society, both to individuals and to the society writ large. On the phone with us from Toronto is General Lou McKenzie. In studio with me is Rick McConomy, and on the phone from Montreal is Dan Romano. And Dan, I just wanted to relate. We were talking before the break about the stories that that are filtering out in the media events, and you had a little bit of a media event the last week at a demonstration, did you not?
Yes, I did. I'm just so frustrated with the way the media is self-censoring itself, and we are, I mean, de facto living under a bit of Sharia law. It's some mad imams out in Europe and Middle East that are dictating what our media publishes, and I just don't want to accept it. So, yeah, we had a demonstration last Saturday, and I went and joined with my own poster. I didn't want to offend anybody, so I chose a very, very polite, dignified image of Muhammad that I picked up from Muslim literature. This is a painting drawn by Muslims for Muslims that's existed in Central Asia for hundreds of years. It's one of thousands. And I had a very respectful logo on my poster saying Muhammad was a great prophet and he founded a great religion. And I went right into the crowd with that. And, you know, it was very interesting to see the reactions.
What struck me was that somebody screamed at you that they're not provoking, but that you are the provocateur.
Yeah. Well, they were saying that in general, not just to me, but this is when we're arguing later on, is you're the ones who make us violent. We're not a violent people. You're the ones who make us violent. And it's astounding. A lot of people, we did end up speaking a lot afterwards, after a little tussle, and a lot of people are of the opinion that provocation is the same thing as incitement. Now, your listeners will all know that you can't incite people to violence. It's against the law, and it's a very dangerous thing to do, and that's the only limitation to free speech.
And expression or freedom of expression is now being equated with incitement in some quarters.
Right. Well, it's provocation. They're saying provocation. If you say something that doesn't like me and I react angrily, that's incitement. They don't understand the fundamental difference. So they feel justified in however violently they react because, oh, they've been offended. You know, they're really just wants to have been offended. And you know, when I went to this demonstration, I purposely did every single thing that I could to make it as inoffensive as possible.
Dan Romano, President of CAGE, we thank you very much. Our lines are getting backed up.
I'll let you go.
Thanks a lot, Dan.
Thank you.
We're joined now from New York by Nani Darwish. Nani, how are you? Thanks for taking the time.
Hi. Thank you so much for putting me on.
Just for our listeners, Nani Darwish is executive member of Arabs for Israel, but that doesn't begin to tell her story, which is a very dramatic one of a voyage from Egypt through Europe to America. And Nani, you're here with myself and Rick McConomy in the studio, General Lewis McKenzie on the line from Toronto. And we're discussing political correctness on multiple levels, and I wanted to get your take on how political, and in reading some of the articles you've written, on how political correctness actually plays into the hands of the radical Islamists. Particularly
exactly.
In this part, what's behind, particularly in terms of what's behind this new cartoon outrage.
Exactly. Look at today. When we react, they perceive us as afraid of their terrorists. And now we see governments actually promoting terrorism. Just today, the Iranian government has promoted their university students, thousands of them, to register as suicide bombers. And that's a lot of people think that suicide bombers and terrorists are just a fringe group that's not connected to the mainstream of Arab governments and Arab culture. Unfortunately, that is not the truth. They see us trying to appease them. They see our political correctness. We are dealing with them at a different level, and they are dealing with us at the level there is nothing that they feel they can hold.
So we were talking to General McKenzie about the fact that our defense minister here in Canada said that they're going to shoot at our soldiers in Afghanistan if any other publications in Canada run these Muhammad cartoons. You wouldn't agree with that, I presume. You'd take Churchill's position that an appeaser is someone who feeds the crocodile hoping he'll eat him last.
Exactly. I think what's happening, they are trying to give a chilling effect on our freedom of speech in the West. I think that the Muslim world is crossing the line of respect for the rest of the world, the culture of the world. We have to abide by their rules, and they have no respect for our values, our culture, our holy sites. Do you know how they treat...
Nani, could I just interrupt you for a moment? Can you just stay with us for a few more moments? We'll be
sure.
Back right after this. Montreal, we're back, and we were talking today about political correctness and the cost of that political correctness, both on our societal level and our international level. Right now with me in studio is Rick McConomy, in Toronto, General Lou McKenzie, and from New York, Nani Darwish, executive member of Arabs for Israel. And Nani, you were making the point that all our political correctness about these cartoons is playing right into the hands of the Islamist extremists.
Yes, exactly. And how come Muslims who exploded and blew up the Buddha statues in Afghanistan, they desecrate the Star of David, they set churches and synagogues on fires all over the world, but at the same time they're offended by a cartoon? It just amazes me that there is no respect for other religions.
Lou McKenzie, how come we don't have our defense minister talking with the guts of this young lady from New York?
Yeah, Bill, was that for me?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I missed that.
Why doesn't our defense minister talk with the guts of this young lady from New York about respect for pluralism?
I got a funny feeling, and I know the defense minister pretty well, that he wished he could have that comment back. It was sort of singing along with the chorus of other government spokesmen and leaders. So I don't think if he gave it some thought that would be a compliment to the morale of our people in Afghanistan, for God's sake. Their job is to do exactly what we're hopefully doing as we speak, is chasing these guys down and eliminating them. My feeling, and I agree with the comments that have been made, that my feeling is that post 9/11, North America in particular, and Europe, I guess, would be included in that, sort of went back into the appeasement mode. And you remember even our prime minister saying, all these guys need is a job. You know, they've been sort of disenfranchised. And if they only had a future, then they wouldn't be doing these things.
That was the previous prime minister.
Yeah, I mean, that's just unadulterated crap. The fact is that if there's another major attack, say North America, Canada, U.S., I would see political correctness evaporating like early morning fog. I mean, I just think that a one-off in North America, we still don't take it seriously.
Oh, God, I would love to have that as a slogan for our country generally, that political correctness evaporates like early morning fog in all aspects of our lives. Lou McKenzie, I know you're pressed for time. I thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. All the best. Cheers.
Thank you. Nani, could you stay with us during and take a call with
sure.
us? We have Geisa on the phone right now. Geisa, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir. Thank you very much for you bring the very important issue here. Okay, actually, you know, sir, I just give you one little example. After 9/11.
So, Geisa, could you speak a little closer to your phone?
Yeah. After the 9/11, you know, people against Osama because he is a very bad guy, and people, you know, all of us that accepted. They after go to the Saddam, he's real bad guy. And then people accept him. But, you know, then you going to hit his belief, somebody, and especially that, you know, comments give the defense minister regarding about Afghanistan, because that people is not obeying the Islam. Their culture is very, very heavy than Islam. And then, you know, it's just few people, like here in Montreal, is educated people, they accept and don't go to the strike.
So what's your point that the Islamic terrorists are not respecting Islam?
No, he actually not obeying the real Islam. He is not obeying the Muhammad religion of Islam. He have his own culture. He have his own political motive.
Who is he? The terrorists?
Yes, it is like Osama. He's like a real bad guy. You see in Afghanistan, then he is a brother like with Mullah Omar. That time he never advised to Mullah Omar to because of there is females, is no school there.
Well, that's the question we're talking about. No,
I'm just talking because you know these is bad guys and you know that is a part of culture. They don't like to be his woman go to school. But Islam gives the, you know, this is duty for every man and woman to go to the...
We'll be back with a response from Nani Darwish in New York to that point in just one moment right after this. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConomy in studio with me. We're talking about political correctness and the cost of that political correctness, both on our social policies at home and abroad. And right now we've got Nani Darwish, executive member of Arabs for Israel in New York, on how to respond, on how political correctness actually hurts the response to Islamic terror. And we have Geisa from Montreal, who feels that the terrorists aren't really representative of what Islam is about, and we were just asking Nani to comment on that.
I'd like to I wonder how many demonstrations this gentleman participate in against terrorism. Terrorism is giving Islam a bad name, and I see silence from the moderate Muslim. And actually, I see a lot of demonstrations for the cartoon, but I rarely see demonstrations from Muslims in the Arab world and in the Muslim world against all the atrocities committed by Muslims in the name of Islam. While they stand holding the Quran while they are innocent people.
Geisa, have you come out publicly against the terrorism? Geisa, we're wondering if you have come out and spoken and demonstrated against this terrorism. And basically, Nani, I want to tell a simple story about 10 years ago when I was in Damascus and we were at a French international conference on the law. And I brought along about 10 or 12 books for the dean of the law faculty in Damascus University and offered them to him. And he said to me he'd have to put them in his private collection because they had 16,000 students in the law faculty, but they only used one book. It sounded a little bit like Mao's China when we were sending out people for a cultural revolution. And this seems to be, that's 10 years ago, and this seems to be exactly what's happening.
It's very sad, and the same people who are saying Islam is a religion of peace are cheering in Arab streets for people like Osama bin Laden. That is the paradox that we are facing in the West. And I suggest that we end political correctness right now. We don't need to wait for another 9/11.
Nani Darwish, we thank you very much for being with us. We know you're at an airport, and we thank you very much for your time and wish you all the best, and we'll have you on again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nani.
Bye-bye. Thank you,
Nani. Well, Rick, we've taken a look today at how political correctness has hurt us in our everyday lives, in our street-level lives, how it's hurt us in foreign policy, and how all these little chipping away, these little infringements and abridgments of our own civil liberties are distracting us from the real stories, and we're not getting enough attention on the real stories. On the large stories, and our next guest is One of those large stories that really didn't get enough attention this week as we were worrying about co-eds and jaywalkers and everything else. And from Vancouver, I'd like to welcome Roger Sauvé, director of the Vanier Institute for the Family, 7th Annual Report on Family Finances. How are you, Roger? Roger, thanks for taking the time.
I'm very well, Beryl.
The Vanier Institute has been around for several decades, over 3 decades, and this is the 7th year in which it's come up with a report, and this is very disturbing, that since 1990, there has been a marginal 10-cent an hour increase after inflation, which means that the average Canadian household is making $500 more a year today than in 1990. And this story is one of these real important societal issues that doesn't get the treatment it deserves as we're worrying about all the rest of the stuff. Roger, what was the mechanisms for coming up with these numbers?
Well, first of all, most of the numbers come from numbers published by Statistics Canada. Again, they have a wonderful database. And I guess my approach when I write this is I try to present a balanced view, bring out the numbers on incomes, on employment, on debt, on stress, on other factors, but try to present a global perspective, at least for Canada, on family finances.
And basically, have we been talking about increasing spending far beyond the increase in revenue?
Yes. No, definitely we've seen, let's say if we take the last 5 years, we can all remember that short time period, the average household income has been flat, no increase at all. We've seen spending climb. We've seen indebtedness shoot straight up. And at the same time, Canadians, at least on an aggregate basis, are saving nothing. Actually, the last year was the first year since the Great Depression. I'm not making too many correlations there.
Right.
But since the Great Depression where our savings were negative. We spent more last year than we took in, and we did that by...
Now, if your average family is having such an awful time, okay, and why is it that we're getting this? The last 15 years, we've been hearing nothing but raves about the performance of the economy and the amount of money that's being made. Are we back into that gap between the rich and the poor?
Well, there's always been that gap, and definitely it's grown a bit, not a whole bunch, but it definitely has grown over the last 15 years, where more and more of the wealth is going to the top 20%, or it could even be the top 5%, and no less going to that group in the middle.
The middle and the lower ends.
Roger, your report came out just 3 weeks after a StatsCan report that showed that 51% of working Canadians earn $21,000 or less a year. I want to pursue that with you right after this break as to whether we're not spending too much money into the politically correct multicultural complex of programs, the touchy-feely kind of programs, and not enough in really expanding our economy. We'll be right back with Roger Sauvé of the Vanier Institute right after this. Montreal, we're back. Rick McConomy in studio with me. And on the phone from Vancouver, Roger Sauvé, the author of the Vanier Institute's 7th Annual Report on Family Finances that showed that since 1990, household income has only gone up $500 in Canada. And we're making the point all day on multiple levels how political correctness has hurt priorities in our society, has hurt individuals in our society. And we're talking to Roger about whether or not the government is spending its money in the right places, because we've got this massive, groaning, multicultural, touchy-feely complex of programs that are twice as big as the defense budget, yet just 3 weeks before the Vanier Institute's report, StatsCan released a report that showed 51% of working Canadians earn $21,000 or less a year, and the next 20% are $34,000 or less a year. And Rick, you're just asking Roger a question about that at the break.
Roger, the question I have is this $500 increase. Now, do I understand correctly that notwithstanding the fact that over those 15 years, there's more and more and more dual career marriages, there's more and more people that are coming out from the family who have to go out to work, who are going out to work, and the impact that is having and the sacrifice it means socially to childcare and the rest, is that we've got a $500 increase in overall income?
basically that's the situation, and just to make sure we don't jump to too many conclusions, that is after tax. So we
that's a hell of a conclusion, okay. Roger, because it means the government is getting a lot more benefit than the individuals who are working. Because when we were growing up, you know, a one income earning household took care of everybody rather well.
Yeah, no, definitely. We're in a situation now where families, you've got record numbers of dual-income families. You've got record numbers of single parents that are out there working. You've got, Canadians are stuck in a bind where, hourly earnings, again, they're up a dime in 15 years.
God, it's unbelievable.
But the corollary of that is that all this money that's coming in to the households, Roger and Rick, means that the household gets to keep $500. The government gets all this extra tax base, which supposedly they're returning to us in terms of these state programs for which we're ceding any kind of control over our lives. But that doesn't really help us because there's no money left at the end of the day to pay for anything past what the government decides and suggests to give us.
It means
minimum level.
The second spouse is just defending the level that the family is at because the government is at the door pounding away to get more and more money.
Or to give our listeners a concrete example, it means less than $5 a day daycare.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I'm sort of on the same wavelength, but we do have to remember that in the last 15 years, and especially the last 3 or 4 years, governments have backed off, at least on when it comes to income tax. Maybe there's more service fees, et cetera. But when it comes to income taxes, families are paying right now about $1,800 less in income taxes than they did 3 or 4 years ago. So there has been.
Yeah, but it takes two of them working to be able to make it work.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, definitely families are stressed out, and I'd say it would be especially those that are under the age of 50, which includes a whole bunch of the boomers.
You got that right.
And they just can't make ends meet, and they're trying hard. And then the
divorce rate goes through the roof.
Montreal,
right? They try and split it up.
Rick, Montreal, this is what we've been talking about all day, that we're selling our own consequence, our own sense of individuality for a few bucks from the government, and it's really not making that much of a difference, whatever.
And we are paying for it.
And we are paying through the nose. We're
Roger, thank you for coming.
At that time again. And we thank you, Montreal, for listening. Rick, thanks as always. Our producer, Val Prudnikov, our technical whiz, Chris Bunbury. Montreal, for God's sakes, get angry. And I leave you with a few words from Robbie Burns. A fig for those by law protected liberties, a glorious feast. Courts for cowards were erected. Churches built to please the priest. Montrealers, get out there and get angry. We're out of here.